Let's take our Bibles, turn to Genesis chapter 38. That's where we're going to be today, Genesis chapter 38. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to be looking at the story of Tamar. Find Genesis 38, and then if you would, turn up to Matthew chapter 1. So we're going to be in Genesis 38, but I want to read Matthew chapter 1 as we start to get the setting for where we're going to be. Matthew 1, verse 1, the Bible says, "The book of the genealogy of Jesus the Christ." This is important. He's establishing the right of Jesus to make claims to be the son of David, to make claims to be within the people of God, to be a representative of God's people. "The book of genealogy of Jesus the Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. And Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar." Now, this is the first interjection we have of a lady in the lineage of Jesus Christ. And then it says, "Perez was the father of Hezron, Hezron the father of Ram," so on and so forth, down to verse 5. "Salmon was the father of Boaz by Rahab. Boaz was the father of Obed by Ruth. And Obed the father of Jesse, Jesse the father of David the king. David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah." So in just six verses, as we're beginning to examine the lineage of Jesus, the Christ, the anointed one, the sovereign one who's going to represent God's people, the one who is going to save his people from their sins, we're connecting Jesus to David and David to Abraham, but we're also connecting Jesus to these women, Tamar, Ruth, Rahab, and then one who's not named, just simply called the wife of Uriah. And so here David has a baby with somebody else's wife. These are stories, three of these at least, they come into the narrative as Gentiles. Tamar is outside of the covenant people. Rahab, outside the covenant people. Ruth, outside the covenant people. Three of these come into the story by means of, or at least with reference to, explicit sexual immorality. And as we come to this story, there's some concern in my household. "Dad, do we need a junior church for this one?" As we look at this story, it's important for us to note that God is not afraid to include the stories of human failure, even gross human failure, particularly when they become the vehicles by which he displays his divine success. When we think of the story of Christmas, we think of a cute little baby. We think of this nostalgic scene with straw. And yes, there might be frost kind of on the edges of the picture because that makes a pretty good picture, right? We don't think about how cold it might actually have been. We don't think of the stench there in the stall. We see a pretty cleaned up manger stall. So when we think of the manger, we think of this warm, bright, beautiful picture of Jesus coming inside the story with all of the attendant glow that is Christmas. And it's not bad for us to think about that because Jesus brings God's light into the darkest of nights. But there's also the stench. There's also the cold. There's also the brokenness. And that's what we have to examine as we look at this story this morning. Well, last week we began a series on the seed of the woman. That promise that was given way back in the book of Genesis, Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, the very first chapter that we have, the fall of humanity, where Eve took of that fruit. She saw that it was good, and she took that goodness for herself. She wasn't longing for something that was evil. It was part of that which is very good. But God said, don't take it. Don't take it. It's not yours to take. And she reached out and she took it. And in taking it, she turned and she gave it to her husband. And her husband listened to the voice of his wife rather than listening to the voice of God. And God comes on the scene. He comes inside the story. He walks with his fallen humanity and says, now you've done it. But this isn't the end of the story. In fact, it's just the beginning. It's the beginning of a long story. And he talks about the seed of the woman and how that seed of the woman is going to crush the head of the serpent. And so we asked last week, what is it that this promises? What's the promise in this proto-evangelium, the first mention of the gospel? And the promise is that which has brought death inside the story. Because God said, in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die, right? Now that's unleashed. And that vehicle by which death entered into the story, and then death passed upon all men, for all have sinned because of the sin of Adam, God has promised to undo death itself. And as the seed of the woman crushes that head of the serpent, he also says that it's going to come at a cost, right? That the serpent will strike the heel of the snake crusher. But in the end, only one wins. And we were reminded that in that garden, there were two trees. One that they were instructed not to eat of. One that they had not yet taken advantage of eating from. And that was the tree of life there in the garden. And so because that was still a possibility for them to reach out and grab hold of this fruit and be locked forever in their fallen condition, in their broken condition, God said, I'm going to block the way. I'm going to put them out of the garden. I will still give them access to life. But I'm going to give them access to life through a tree of life, which in fact first looks like death. It's going to be life through death. And it's going to be a life that is not taken, but a life that is given for them to receive. I want you to turn your Bibles to the end of the story. Go back to Revelation chapter 21 for just a second. Revelation 21. Way at the end of the story, the opposite end of Genesis. But I want you to see what he promises in Revelation 21. Verse 5. He who was seated on the throne said, behold, I am making all things new. I'm recreating. I'm giving a new creation. What does he even mean by that? We'll go back one verse. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. My friend, if God didn't block access to that tree of life back in the garden, this would be your reality forever. You know it. You taste it. You've participated in the tears, the death, the mourning, the crying, the pain. You know what that's about. You have no idea what life looks like apart from it, but you're hoping for it and you're waiting for it. If God didn't block the tree of life in our broken condition, this would be our condition forever. Aren't you thankful he blocked access to that? But now he gives us access through a tree by which the life of his suffering servant was exhausted, was spilt out, was poured out, so that he can give life to everyone who will simply receive. Not having to manipulate, not having to take. That's what Christmas is about. That's what we celebrate. But it's bigger than just a cow stall. It's bigger than just a manger. It's bigger than just Bethlehem. This is what Galatians 4, verse 4 calls the fullness of time. In the fullness of time, God sent forth His Son, born of a virgin, born under the law, to redeem those who are under the law, that He might make them sons, giving them His Spirit by which they cry out, God, You are our Father, Abba. What an amazing story. But the story takes a lot of turns, a lot of twists. Last week we looked at Leah and how her part in the story was just a foretaste of the praises of God that are going to be unlocked by the lips of this hurting humanity. Today we're going to look at the life of Tamar and how she brings us to the Lion of the tribe of Judah. What I want us to see this morning from the life of Tamar is this, that the seed of the woman comes in the ugly context of real life, but it has a purpose of, He has a purpose of arriving in this context, and that purpose is this, that He might reveal to us the beauty of God's grace. So while I painted a picture of the Thomas Kincaid Christmas, right? The soft edges aglow with frost, and maybe the breath of the cow, and so on. We've got all these picturesque, there's some beauty to that, right? And it's not wrong for us to capture that beauty, to see the goodness inside the cold, dark, and stark reality of a broken world. Because that's what Jesus came to bring. Jesus came to bring light in darkness. Jesus came to bring warmth to cold hearts. Jesus came to bring life to stony hearts. Jesus came to reverse life as we know it, to be done with these former things so that they can pass away, so that everything can become new, so that God can be all in all. That's why Jesus came. So as we look at this story, I want us to see four different ways in which God's story is going to move forward in the context of real life. And the real life as it's presented here in Genesis chapter 38 is pretty stark. Let's start in verse 1. Genesis chapter 38, verse 1. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And there Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. And yet again she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. And Judah was in Kizib when she bore him. Now, if that doesn't bless you, I'm not surprised. Okay. It happened at that time. So this is the first verse of chapter 38. It's opening things up. At that time, it's referencing something before that. Probably chapter 37, if I were to guess, right? So at that time, what had happened in the context of this story about Judah? Well, we're gonna pick that up. And as we do, what we're gonna find is that as Tamar enters into this story, like all of us, none who enter this story enter God's story by our own merit. Tamar is gonna come into this story in a way that is unanticipated, in a way that we couldn't come up with human conjecture. She comes into this story because of the waywardness of God's child, Judah. He's part of the chosen family. He's part of the blessed family of Abraham. In fact, he's part of the blessed family of Jacob, not Esau. So this should be one of those heroic champions that he's from the tribe of, well, he is the tribe of Judah at this point, right? So this is the one that we saw. Leah's included because Judah's included. And Judah's the guy. So we're going to hear Judah's story. What's Judah's story so far? Well, Judah is one of six sons of Leah. We looked at that last week. And we see that way back in chapter 35, that the birthright, which would belong to Jacob's son, his firstborn, was called into question. Especially as we're talking about the birthright being the very blessing of God himself. Reuben went and slept with his father's wife. And it just kind of mentions it in passing, but it's one of those big red flags that goes off in your head. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. Did that just say what I thought it said? How? Okay, something's wrong here. The blessing that's supposed to pass from father to son, that puts a huge question mark on things. And we come down to chapter 34, just before this little tidbit is given about Reuben, and we read about how Dinah, their sister, had been defiled. And so they make this deal with the Canaanites in that land. They make this deal: if you circumcise all your men, then we'll intermarry with you, and we can live at peace. And on the third day, when the men are healing up and they're still vulnerable and they're not able to come out and fight, the next two sons after Reuben, Simeon and Levi, go in and they kill all the guys. They take advantage of them as they're at a disadvantage. They kill the men. They take the women and the children for themselves. They plunder them. So you have this taking and killing. And Jacob's going to remember both of these events later on when he passes his blessing on to his children. He's going to say, I remember that Reuben went up to my couch. He violated my sexuality by sleeping with my wife. I'm not going to pass this blessing on to him. And I'm not going to pass this blessing on to the hot-headed boys that went in and killed all these people and made my name a stench among the Gentiles. I'm not going to pass my blessing on to them. Well, guess what? The fourth one is Judah. Bing, 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 bing. Okay, Judah, the blessing is yours. It's yours for the taking. Chapter 37. Reuben wants to rescue Joseph. When the brothers see Joseph, the favorite of dad, the most blessed of all the sons of Jacob, they see him coming. They're out watching the sheep. They say, hey, let's get rid of this guy. They throw him down in a pit, and Reuben has this idea, you know what, if I rescue daddy's favorite boy, maybe I'll get in good with daddy once again. And so he goes off, and he's going to come back, and he's going to rescue Joseph at some point when the brothers aren't watching, they're not looking for it. But while he's gone, Judah has this brilliant idea, hey, let's get rid of the brat. We can even make some money on it. And so they sell him to these Midianite traders who are going down to Egypt, and by the time Reuben gets back, he's gone. Joseph's gone. Whose idea was it? Judah's. If you think that that's endearing to a father's heart, that one of the sons sells a brother, Judah had things backwards, right? There is no way now that Judah has earned the right to that blessing that's been forfeited by his three older brothers. Not only does he sell Joseph, but they come up with this idea, this brilliant idea, to hide the fact that Joseph's gone. So they take his coat of many colors, and they kill one of the sheep, and they splatter the blood on that coat of many colors to make it look like poor Joseph lost a battle that was inevitable. Some beast came out, got a hold of him, and so they send the robe back to Dad and say, Dad, will you please identify this robe? All of this is very, very pertinent and important when it comes to this story. Judah refuses to give honor to a lesser son. That lesser son was Joseph, who had dreams, by the way, of greatness, right? Dreams from God that all of the sons of Israel would bow down to him. Judas is not me. Not this boy. I will not bow down to my younger brother. I'm going to get rid of him before I ever see that day happen. So what's at stake? The birthright, the blessing, the priority of the younger over the elder. And Judas says, no, not on my watch. So what's going to happen in chapter 38? Well, Judah's going to be deceived. Judah is going to father two children, and of those two children, the younger will be over the older. And God's going to make happen in his own house what he refuses to allow to happen in God's household as the family blessing. That's what's going on here. So it says in verse 1, it happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and he turned aside. We're not told why he went down from his brothers. They've all gone back. Joseph is gone. But at the end of chapter 37, we see that all his sons and daughters rose up to comfort poor Jacob, but he refused to be comforted by them. So maybe it's just to get away from a weeping dad. Maybe it's meant to get away from the guilt. Somehow, Judah just doesn't want to be there anymore. So he leaves. He leaves his brothers. They can do their own life. They're making a mess of things. I'm going to go live my own life. And he goes. He walks away. Verse 2, there Judah saw the daughter of a Canaanite woman, and he took her. These two words should, again, throw up fireworks in our mental imagery. Okay, we've seen way back in chapter 3, Eve saw the fruit, and when she saw the fruit, what did she do? She took the fruit. Over and over again, you have this pattern throughout the book of Genesis that man keeps taking that which doesn't belong to him. Genesis 6:3, the sons of God take the daughters of men. Chapter 12, verse 15, Pharaoh takes Sarah to be his wife. Chapter 20, verse 2, Abimelech takes Sarah to be his wife. In chapter 27, verse 35, Jacob takes the blessing by deception. So when we see this word takes, he saw and he took, we're working against the grain of God's blessing. In fact, we're working right with the grain of God's curse. This is Judah, okay? But what did he see and what did he take? There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite. Why should that grab our attention? God had promised Eve that there's coming the seed of the woman. There's coming someone, Eve. And he's going to be disconnected from man in such a way that the sinfulness of Adam will not be passed on to this one. The woman, the virgin woman, eventually will be the one who brings forth this seed, this child, to crush the head of the serpent. This promise is then reiterated to Abraham and says, listen, I will give you a land. I will give you a blessing. I will give you a seed. I will give you an offspring. And this land I will give to your seed. This land I will give to your offspring. Paul highlights the fact that that's a singular noun in the New Testament. He says, not to offsprings many, but to the one. He's referencing Jesus at this point. So this seed of the woman is promised to be the seed of Abraham. Abraham, who's separate from the sinfulness of the people in that region. In fact, he's going to inherit the land of these sinful people. Back in Genesis chapter 15, God says, Abraham, I'm not going to give you this land just yet because the sin of these people is not yet full. I'm going to let them keep on sinning, keep earning my wrath, and at that right time, I'm going to take away their land, punishing them and blessing you. And who does Judah think it's a great idea to team up with? The people that God has promised to destroy. You see now how important that one little word Canaanite in this story is? Judah is going to team up with those who are outside of God's people. It kind of has this Genesis 6 feel. The sons of God took for themselves the daughter of men. We have this mixing of the races, the blessed people, the cursed people. Judah's doing a Genesis 6 thing all over again. So we're kind of meant to wait. Okay, God's going to drop the hammer on this one. What's that going to look like? He's earned it. The guy's going deep. Boom. So she bears three children to Judah. And verse 6, Judah took a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. Firstborn. Ah, that's a loaded phrase, right? Esau was the firstborn. Jacob steals the blessing. Ishmael was the firstborn. Isaac receives the blessing. Firstborn and blessing. What's going to happen here? Firstborn. And then we see in verse 7 that word reiterated a second time. Two verses, one significant word. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord. So what does God do for him in verse 7? The Lord put him to death. The wickedness of the peoples. And understand what kind of wickedness we're talking about. This term and the judgment that coincides with this term are direct interventions of God. This is a Genesis 6 kind of wickedness where the earth is filled with wickedness. Man's heart is filled with evil. He does only evil continually. And because of the evil of this wickedness, God reaches in and judges directly and deals with that wicked humanity. It's the same term that's used in Genesis 19 with the wickedness of Sodom and Gomorrah. And God reaches in directly and judges those people. That's the kind of wickedness that we're told that was committing. Where does learn this kind of wickedness? In the house of Judah. Judah who teams up with the Canaanites. Huh. Okay, there's a lot going on in these first few verses. And God's not going to let them get away with it. That's the point. Verse 7, God struck him dead. So, verse 8, Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring to your brother. The duty of a brother-in-law, it's all one word in the Hebrew, and it's explained for us in Deuteronomy 25, where if a brother is married and he dies before having children, then his younger brother takes the wife and their first child together becomes the offspring of the older brother so that the inheritance goes to him and the name goes to him and all of those household responsibilities falls on that right of the firstborn that's passed on through that. So there's something that's happening here. Tamar has been married to the firstborn. Tamar, who's an outsider to God's people, she's brought in. Now all of a sudden, through no fault of her own and by God's justice, she's made a widow. She's made a widow in her childlessness. None who enters God's story does so with merit, and none who experience God's story are free from deep hurt. I don't know what was harder, being married to or the fact that he died, leaving her a widow. We're not told. Was his wickedness toward her? Was his wickedness... We have no idea what the wickedness of looks like other than God says it was bad enough to strike him dead. And by the way, I'm just when I do it. Tamar, welcome to the story. That's a little rough. If you're Tamar, You come in and your husband is a spiritual loser. In fact, it's stamped so deeply it strikes him dead. Okay. So what was supposed to be hers, being married to the firstborn, she's supposed to inherit daddy's wealth. In fact, the way it worked was that you take all the kids that this father has, so he had three, and then you add one more, so three kids, but there's four portions. That means the first child gets two portions, and the others get one portion each. So the firstborn gets a double portion, and the others get single portions. So she stood to receive a double portion of Judah's wealth. Now, it must have been a little bit substantial, because by the end of the story, she's going to ask for his signet, which is hanging on a cord from his neck, and this staff, which would have been specially designed, kind of like your saw, Ron. It was specially designed, handcrafted just for you. Everybody who sees that, you got it right there. Everybody who sees the staff knows whose it belongs to. Nobody who sees that here thinks it belongs to Ray or to John or to Wesley, right? We know it's Ron's. That's the kind of deal. But men who were making business transactions, men who frequented the gates of the city, men who were at the cutting edge of economics were the ones who wore these signets. They would roll it in the clay and it would leave their mark. They didn't have to sign it. It was carved into their signet, and they would just roll it in there as they made transaction after transaction, bettering their welfare within the community. And that's what Judah was all about. And he had gained for himself some sort of accumulation of wealth. And Tamar was in line to receive it. She's doing well in the Canaanite culture. She's doing good according to the economy of planet Earth. She's keeping up with the Joneses and then some, right? She's driving the latest and greatest. And now, in an instant, it's gone. Onan stands now to gain because his brother's out of the way, so he can get the inheritance. But what does daddy say? Now, we got to do this right, son. Your sister-in-law, by rights, gets a double blessing, a double portion. So let's help her out. You have to be the one who brings a child to her. So he goes into her. Verse 9, Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. That means the wealth would not be his. So whenever he went into his brother's wife, he'd waste the semen on the ground so as not to give offspring to his brother. The whole purpose was so that the brother did not get a child. That was the purpose. So that was what he was trying to do. He was trying to avoid somebody else getting this blessing. So what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, verse 10, and he put him to death also. God is not letting the boys of Judah get away with sin. God is seeing, God's watching. He's keeping track of the sins of those who are inside his people. These sins that are bringing hurt to those who are outside the people of God. This story so far is working backwards, right? What had God promised Abraham? Through you, all outsiders will be blessed. That's awesome. But now, through the insiders, the outsiders are being hurt. The outsiders are experiencing God's curse. This isn't the way it's supposed to go, as far as the divine storyteller had set this up for us. Okay. So as we work through this text, we see that now she's without husband number two. Verse 11, then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, why don't you remain a widow in your father's house until Shelah, my son, grows up? Husband number three. Why did Judah say this to her? Because he feared that Shelah would die, just like his brothers. Obviously, there's a problem here. Any man who marries this woman dies. Okay? She's the jinx. She's a curse. She has bad luck. She has bad karma. If I take my son and I wed her, well, wait a minute. What did I do? I married the people of the curse. Judah's not thinking like that yet, right? This isn't my fault. This is her fault. So since she's obviously cursed, I don't want to wed my son to her. Why don't you go home? Live in your father's house, having no children. Sometimes it's really nice to hear things from a woman's perspective, all right? Nana Dolce writes on this text. She says this: a daughter is supposed to leave her father's house and establish life in another family. She's not expected to return childless, impoverished, bereaved of two husbands, and presumably full of bad luck. Oh, how the town must have gossiped about poor Tamar. When Tamar comes back to live in daddy's house, everybody knew about it. And they know how life is supposed to work. You get married, you go build into that family, you are part of that family's wealth, and obviously Judah is wealthy. People are seeing him, he's moving forward. He's making a name within the community. And all of a sudden, this girl comes back home. No wealth, no property, no husband, no children. This outcast Tamar is languishing away from God's covenant family, and it's because of superstition, not faith, and a neglect of duty. Remember what Abraham was told to teach his children? God says, I want Abraham to teach his children my ways so that they will follow righteousness with God and justice with man. Judah at this point is neither right with God nor treating his daughter with justice. Oh, he tried, kind of, but now when push comes to shove, I can't afford it. It's more about me. I can't afford justice on this point because my life isn't right, and my not being right has now begun to affect others. So that's where this story goes. This is how Tamar gets into the story. Isn't this beautiful? She doesn't get there because she's some beauty queen. She doesn't get there because she's some moral princess. She gets there as somebody who's used and abused, taken, used up, and thrown away. Thank you very much. But folks, that's about as real as life gets, isn't it? How many times have you seen somebody taken advantage of, used up, and then thrown aside so that they can use somebody else until they're used up and thrown? How many times have you felt taken advantage of, used up, and thrown aside? That's just life. It's just life. And so we build this crust, and nobody's going to get close. And we put up our dukes, and we start to give this protective ring. Nobody's going to get close to me. I'm going to push everybody out. Well, let's see where the story goes. Verse 12. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, dies. We don't even ever find out the name of Judah's wife. She's just this Canaanite lady who's the daughter of Canaanite Shua. So she remains nameless. When Judah was finally comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers, the one who are taking care of his flock. And he's going at the time where they're going to shear the sheep. There's going to be some abundance. There's going to be some profit. And he's all about profit. So he goes up with his friend Hira that we met up in verse 1. And when Tamar was told that your father is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's garments, she covered herself with a veil, and she wrapped up herself and sat at the entrance to Enaim, probably a small little village there where he's going. And then she goes, it's on the road to Timnah, and she saw that Shelah, that son number three, is of an age where she could marry him. But Judah is not making that a possibility for her. So, verse 15, when Judah saw Tamar sitting alongside of the road with the veil, he thought she was a prostitute. Here's a man who's all about taking advantage of life, bettering himself, whatever the cost, using people and throwing them to the side. A prostitute, somebody else to take advantage of. Okay, so he goes and he turns to her and says, "Let me come to you." He didn't know that she was his daughter-in-law. So she strikes a bargain. She said, "Two can play this game. Judah, I know which economy you live by. I'm a part of that economy." So she says, "Well, what will you give me so that you can come into me?" He answered, I'll give you a young goat from the flock. I'll buy you for the price of an animal." Wow. How would that make you feel? I'll buy you for the price of an animal. She says, what's your pledge? You don't have an animal with you. Well, how about your signet cord and your staff that's in your hand? So he gives them to her. Goes in, has sexual intercourse with her. And that little phrase there in verse 18, and she conceived by him. Nobody knows that in the moment but God, right? Okay. Nobody knows that in the moment but God. But God knows it. In fact, God orchestrated it. She manipulated it, but God orchestrated it. Verse 19, she arose and went away, took off her veil, put on the garments of her widowhood. And when Judah sends to fulfill his pledge, they can't find her. Here, go take this sheep, go take this goat, and fulfill my pledge. Get my signet back. I've got more money to make. I've got more business to conduct. I've got a greater name to make within this community. Don't worry about the fact that I just blew my name and my reputation and all of my integrity. I just threw that out the window. Go get my signet, and let's settle accounts. He goes. Can't find her, so he asks, verse 21, "Where's the cult prostitute who was here at the roadside?" Cult prostitution was a little more elevated than the normal prostitution. In our 21st century American biblical context, we don't quite understand that. But this is the world into which Judah had married. This is the world that he chose to be a part of and wanted to engage with. So he's looking for this cult prostitute. There's no cult prostitute here. Verse 23, so Judah replies, "Let her keep the things. We're going to get laughed at. We're going to have a name, and that name's not going to be good. Let's just say nothing more about this matter. Let's pretend it didn't happen. You know that I tried to do right by her." Right? I tried to do right by her while taking advantage of her. Verse 24. About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. In fact, she's pregnant by immorality." Never mind, Judah, that you've been immoral. Your daughter's been immoral and she's pregnant by immorality. And so he says to her, "Bring her out and let her be burned." Wow. That's pretty harsh. I mean, he had that right, but it's the right of a God. If you can give life, then you have the right to take life. If you can create life, then you have the right to uncreate life. If you can't make life, not just in like having sexual intercourse and engaging in the process of procreation, if you can't make that child, you have no right to destroy that child whose life was given by God. And Judah says, "Take her life because of her sin." Lights should be going off all over the place, right? Not blue light specials at Kmart. This is red light, destructive kind of warning signals. Judah is calling for the death of somebody who has sinned, and he has lived for a long time in sin. coupling with people, doing economy with people who are people outside God's covenant. So, verse 25, as she's being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, by the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant. And she said, please identify whose these are. What were the words that Judah sent back to Jacob? Jacob, here's a coat. Will you please identify if this belongs to your son? Those very words come back and bite him. Judah, would you please identify who these belong to? As we watch the story of Tamar play out, she's wise in the world in which she lives, right? She knows how to play the game. She knows how to work in this economy. She disguises herself, and she sets herself up to receive the blessing the same way that Rebekah and Jacob had set up to steal the blessing from Esau. She's playing the same game. But this blessing of God doesn't pass from person to person by transaction. It passes from person to person by God's choice, by God's sovereignty, by God overseeing the context. None who participate in God's story gets to be the hero of this story. Judah's not the hero. Tamar's not the hero. God's going to be the hero of this story. And as she brings out these instruments, she points out, I'm pregnant by the man to whom these belong. Then Judah identified them, verse 26, and he said, she is more righteous than I. She is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not know her again. One last point I want us to take from this morning is this. All who participate in God's story get to experience God's grace. This is God's story. Now, the Bible doesn't condemn her for what she does. We have to understand that she's operating in the context of immorality. She's operating in the context of brokenness. This is the life that she knows, and it was hers by right to receive the inheritance by having a child with the closest of kin to her husband, who's gone twice. She has a right for the security, the financial security of being taken care of in this way. Now, this is a dangerous move because it could cost her life, and it almost does. But here's the point. When Judah could care less about God's promise through the seed, Tamar is absolutely, doggedly concerned about carrying on a blessing through the son, through the child of Judah. She's left her people. She's become one with this people. She's banking on this people to provide the blessing for her security, for her future. And guess what? She gets more than she bargained for. At first, she gets less than what she bargained for. She's not even given an earthly inheritance. But before the story is all said and done, she is written into the lineage of none other than Jesus the Christ. Do you understand what's happening in this story? Judah, who's inside, is not caring about anybody on the outside. Tamar, who's on the outside, is thinking only at the earthly level. God, who's operating on a larger scale than anything, is weaving and working all of the evils of man into the beauty of a tapestry that is going to reveal his glory. And it's going to look like his son. And so we come down to the very end of this passage, verse 27. When the time of her labor came, there wasn't just one child there. God gave a bonus blessing. The last time we see twins in this story is Jacob and Esau. And guess what? The same kind of tension is going to be there. Okay? She's in labor. One of the children puts out its hand. The midwife takes and ties a scarlet thread on his hand, scarlet thread, We know which one came out first. That is the firstborn, right? Okay. So this one came out first, verse 29. But as he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out. And she said, what a breach you've made for yourself, using that word Perez. So she called his name Perez, the breach, the one who pushes out in the place of his brother. Then afterward, his brother came out with a scarlet thread on his hand. His name is called Zerah. But the story ends with the younger brother getting the place of the firstborn. And that's exactly what happens. So now if we go back and look at the book of Matthew, it says that, well, let's go back and look at Matthew chapter 1. We're just introduced to these two boys, both now sons of Judah, not by his wife, but by his daughter-in-law. Verse 2 of Matthew 1, Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac is the father of Jacob, Jacob is the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah is the father of Perez and Zerah, two of them, by Tamar, and Perez is the father of Hezron, and so on. He's going to follow Perez. Perez, the one who did not come out first, but gets the blessing of the firstborn. Do you understand what's going on? In all of these things, Judah's brothers have been disallowed from the inheritance because they've defiled his father's wife. They've taken advantage of the peoples around them, and these are almost the same things that Judah does. He takes advantage not of his father's wife, but of his son's wife. And again, he takes advantage of the people that are around. We should be giving her a blessing, and he sends her away empty-handed. Empty-handed. Wants no responsibility for her whatsoever. And yet, this is going to be the one that God chooses to bring his son into the world. What's going on? What's different about Judah? Well, we saw it there in verse 24, did we not? Verse 24, where, oh, I lost it. Genesis 38, verse 25, as she was being brought out, she said, I'm pregnant by the man to whom these belong. And he said, she is more righteous than I. You know what Judah does with his sin? He acknowledges it. And that's going to make all the difference. He says, you know what? I was unrighteous, and her, in her grabbing and manipulating and trying to get what actually belongs to her, she is more righteous than I. I'm the unrighteous one. Let her live. And by implication, if anyone should die, it should be me. In fact, that's what's going to happen as the story moves forward. Joseph is going to go down. Simeon's going to stay in the land of Egypt when the brothers go down for grain. They come back. Simeon stays in jail. They say, Dad, we got to go down. We got to get more food. Reuben says, Dad, you can trust Benjamin with me, right? If he dies, you can kill my two kids. Oh, great. Now not only do I lose a son, but I lose two grandsons. Judah pipes up and says, Dad, I'll bring him back. In fact, I'll die before he doesn't come back. And in fact, Benjamin's taken down in Egypt. Joseph says, nope, Benjamin stays. Judah says, you can have my life, but let him go. It'll cost my father his life if you keep this one. I'll give my life for my brothers. Does that not sound like somebody that we celebrate today? Jesus Christ, who died on a cross, he says, I will give my life for my brothers so that they might have life. I will taste death. Judah repents of his sin and is willing to give his life for his brothers. And this is the grace of God's story. What a beautiful story. What an ugly story. But it's in this ugly story that God's beauty is revealed, because the story is not about us. All we can bring is filth to this story. Your filth might not look like this filth, but it's filth. All you bring to the story is filth, but all you receive from God is grace. My friend, if you think that your story is so broken and so ugly that God can't redeem it, read again the life of Tamar. It's not that broken, I guarantee. And God gave her a beautiful gift of his grace. That, my friend, is what he wants to do for you. Will you receive it? You say, Pastor, you don't know what I have in my past. I don't. But we just read a pretty ugly past. And we just read about a God who wants to give you more than you deserve. And that's the point. That's who he is. It's not about you. It's about him. Will you let that be about him this Christmas as he emphasizes the beauty of Jesus Christ? Let's pray.